News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Key U.S. senators said Tuesday there was overwhelming evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was behind the killing of a dissident Saudi journalist inside Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul in October. They rejected President Trump's claim that the case against him wasn't convincing. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a prominent Republican senator, said there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw.
If the Saudi government is going to be in the hands of this man for a long time to come, I find it very difficult to be able to do business because I think he's crazy. I think he is dangerous.
Graham said he went into the briefing with CIA Director Gina Haspel, believing it was virtually impossible for the Khashoggi killing to be carried out without the Crown Prince's knowledge. He says he left the briefing with high confidence that his assessment was correct. Tens of thousands of Israeli women protested across the country Tuesday, calling on the government to do more to stop domestic violence that has claimed the lives of 24 women and girls this year. The women blocked roads, shut down universities, even temporarily stopped working at Ben-Gurion Airport, Israel's main international airport, causing delays. President Trump met with executives from three top German car makers, BMW, Daimler, and Volkswagen, at the White House Tuesday. All sides are hoping to avoid a European trade war. The White House says Trump shared his vision of all automakers producing in the United States and creating a more friendly business environment. But in an earlier tweet, Trump called himself a tariff man. This is VOA News. Ukraine says Russia has begun allowing some ships to enter Ukrainian ports on the Sea of Azov. It's a possible sign of easing tensions in the area. A statement Tuesday from Ukraine's infrastructure minister said two ports had been partially unblocked, and ships are also moving through the Kerch Strait towards Ukrainian ports. The French prime minister has announced a suspension of fuel tax and utility hikes in an effort to appease a protest movement that has plunged Paris into chaos the past few weekends. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the story.
3 weeks ago, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe had insisted the government would not change course on its energy policy. It would remain determined to wean French consumers off polluting fossil fuels. But now the government has announced it will suspend the fuel tax rise, which has led to weeks of violent protests. However, it's unlikely Philippe's announcement will put an end to the road blockades and demonstrations, with more possible protests this weekend in Paris.
The head of the World Food Programme is warning that hundreds of thousands of severely malnourished children in Yemen could die if aid workers are unable to reach them with emergency therapeutic feeding programs. Correspondent Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
While on a visit to Yemen 2 weeks ago, World Food Programme Executive Director David Beasley met scores of skeletal children in an overcrowded hospital in the capital, Sana'a. He says the children he saw had a chance of survival. He also says he worried about the children he did not see, noting they were sent home to die for lack of space to treat them. Beasley says one child dies every 10 or 11 minutes because of the humanitarian consequences of this brutal war. He says WFP is able to reach about 1 million of the estimated 2 million acutely malnourished children. He says there is no access to the other 1 million children living in mainly Houthi-controlled areas.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Tuesday questioned the effectiveness of the current world order. He said the United States is acting to reform global institutions that form the basis of it. He spoke to the German Marshall Fund in Brussels. He said after the Cold War ended, we allowed this liberal order to begin to corrode. It failed us and it failed you. He said China, Iran, Russia, and other countries have violated treaties and multilateral agreements, and said the U.S. would no longer accept such transgressions. He blamed the lack of American and European leadership over the past 30 years for the world's state of affairs, and he said such organizations as the U.N. and the E.U. are in need of reform. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Wednesday, December the 5th. Here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Sudan's long-serving President Omar al-Bashir looks likely to secure another term in office after a majority of lawmakers backed a constitutional amendment to extend term limits that would have required him to step down in 2020. And 60 years ago, a conference convened in Ghana to lay ground for many of the independence movements across Africa. And this week, activists and scholars are convening in Accra to remember this historic conference.
Nkrumah, Josh Padmore from Trinidad, who was the chief architect, and then Tom Boyer and many others, they succeeded in bringing together all the Pan-Africanists and all the leaders who were fighting for the independence of Africa. But today, the weakness of the Pan-African movement, many groups are organized, but they do not work in a coordinated way.
Nyakala Goke is a Pan-African scholar from Ivory Coast. Burundi is hosting the East African Inter-Parliamentarian Games for the first time since 2011. However, there is a marked absence of legislators from neighboring Rwanda. The absence reflects yet a continued deterioration in the relationships between the two countries.
But we want to appeal to heads of state. We want to appeal to the East African Legislative Assembly to ensure that the issue of this relationship between Burundi and Rwanda is handled at that level, because these are brothers and sisters.
Obua Dennis is a Ugandan member of parliament. A new research suggests that African audiences are exposed to more misinformation than American audiences do, and that the public's trust in the media is particularly low in countries like Nigeria. We'll bring you a report on a new initiative that brings together journalists from 16 news outlets whose mission is to collaborate on verifying information spread on social media. Stay tuned, those stories are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And we'll start off in Sudan, where the country's long-serving president, Omar al-Bashir, is likely to secure another term in office after a majority of lawmakers backed a constitutional amendment to extend term limits that would have required him to step down in 2020. The current law, as it stands, does not allow Bashir, who has been president of Sudan since 1989, to stand again when his prison term ends. Mr. Bashir has won two elections since a 2005 constitutional amendment took effect, imposing a two-term limit. The Speaker of Parliament in Sudan said that he had received a letter signed by a majority of lawmakers backing an amendment that would extend the limit. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes after being indicted in 2008 over killings in Sudan's Darfur province between 2003 and 2008. In 2018 marks the 60th anniversary of the All African People's Conference, AAPC, a groundbreaking Pan-African event that took place in Ghana's capital, Accra, in the year 1958. The conference is seen as an important moment in African history in terms of mobilizing Africans to demand for liberation and independence. Nyakala Goke, a scholar from Ivory Coast, will be attending the conference to commemorate the 60th anniversary of AAPC this week in Accra, Ghana. He tells me that the meeting will bring together activist groups, scholars, cultural workers, whose purpose is to reflect on the African condition in the contemporary world.
Are we going to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the first major Pan-African conference organized on the continent of Africa in December 1958 in Ghana.
Now, what was the significance of this conference and why was it convened?
The conference was very important because it was the first major Pan-African conference, and then before that conference organized by Kwame Nkrumah, who became the Prime Minister of Ghana in 1957. Mm-hmm. As we know, Ghana was the first country to be independent in Black Africa. And then, most before that event, many Pan-African gatherings were organized outside the continent of Africa, and they were led by people of African descent, 1900. The conference was organized by Henry Sylvester Williams from Trinidad. Mm. The conventions organized by Marcus Garvey from Jamaica. The congresses organized by W.B. Du Bois from the United States.
So it was one of the most major conferences, or the first major conference organized by Africans,
by a sovereign state.
And what was the intention of Kwame Nkrumah?
Of course, who
are some of the people that attended?
Yes, Kwame Nkrumah, who said that when Ghana became independent, the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it is linked to the total liberation of the continent of Africa, was going to be one of the greatest to advocate the entire decolonization of the continent of Africa. He was going to put resources, the strategy, political leverage, and every other thing with some other leaders, you know, to accelerate the decolonization of Africa. So when in April 1958, they organized the Conference of the Independent African States with Ethiopia and Libya, Egypt and Morocco and Tunisia, and with Liberia. And now they decided to do the same thing for the leaders of political parties, the leaders of unions, for journalists, youngsters and women. 300 people came to that conference from across the globe. And then many of the people who were there at that conference were going to become ambassadors, ministers, prime ministers, and presidents.
Of the respective countries. So it was a conference that convened some of the greatest minds.
Who were fighting for the independence
now,
of Africa.
60 years later.
Before I talk about 60 years later. Lumumba was at that conference, Patrice Lumumba. Kenneth Kaunda was at that conference. Asting Banda from Nyasaland was at that conference. Julius Nyerere was at that conference, just to give you an idea. So now, 60 years later, the topic that we're going to discuss, we want to talk about the unfinished business.
And many of these gentlemen were still activists, young leaders, in their 20s.
For instance, Tom Mboya, Tom Mboya, who was the chairman of the conference. He was 28 at that time.
Kenya's Tom Mboya, who was the foreign minister at the time.
Yes. So he was the one who organized the conference. No, when I was the chairman, he was 28, a great union leader.
Right, one of the greatest minds in Africa. Undoubtedly.
Yes.
6 years later, what are some of the lessons you're drawing from it?
Oh, quickly, the first element is that Nkrumah, Josh Padmore from Trinidad, who was the chief architect, and then Tom Mboya and many others, they succeeded in bringing together all the Pan-Africanists and all the leaders who were fighting for the independence of Africa. But today, the weakness of the Pan-African movement, many groups are organized, but they do not work in a coordinated way. The first lesson that we have to draw from the 1958 conference is the spirit and the desire to do things in a coordinated way, in the spirit of unity and in the spirit of Pan-Africanism. First lesson. Second lesson. It is because Ghana was a liberated zone. It's because Ghana was independent. That's why they could organize that conference. In other words, second lesson, we have to fight, you know, to increase our independence or to conquer our economic independence. Or we have to fight in order to free our respective zones in order for us to better organize and think about a better future of Africa. Second lesson. Third lesson, they spoke about the African personality. Yes, Nkrumah was talking about socialism, but the vision that I'm promoting here, the new disposition of Pan-African that I'm promoting, stands upon an African philosophy, which is in line with the spirit of the African personality that they were talking about. And that philosophy is what Ubuntu. And then this is another lesson. We have to reclaim our value system.
You are because I am.
I am because you guys are.
Right.
Yeah. This is what we're trying to do.
We're taking back. To the grassroots.
Basic philosophy of African existence. African existence. So these are several lessons. Right. We're not going to talk about all of them here, but just to mention those three. And also, it's an opportunity to tell people that people may have forgotten that conference, but like you said. Those Tom Mboya, Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, they did it.
These are people who will always live on.
Oh, yes, they will be eternally in the psyche of Africans because they were doing the right thing. And then we want to commemorate the legacies. We want to commemorate the conference. And it's also a part of our strategy and the spirit of that All African People's Conference, so that on a regular basis, you know, we can continue to organize and strategize for the true independence of the African people.
Nyakalagoke, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jackson. Thanks for your wonderful work.
That was Nyakalagoke, a Pan-African scholar from Ivory Coast. He
was speaking to me, the Voice of America Studios here in Washington, as he was about to embark on his trip to Accra, Ghana. In Burundi is hosting the East African Inter-Parliamentarian Games for the first time since 2011. However, Rwanda's absence at the Games reflects yet a continued deteriorating relationship between the two countries since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office. From Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana reports.
For almost 8 years since Burundi last hosted the East African Community Inter-Parliamentary Games, more than 700 legislators arrived in Bujumbura for the Games after South Sudan declared unfit to host this year's Games. Julius Maganda is Uganda's Minister of State for East African Community Affairs and the Chairman of the Council of Ministers.
There shouldn't be fear in Burundi over insecurity that people have been talking about. There's enough security, and I believe the country seems to be secured now. And we are very free. We just want to encourage the people to come to Burundi, come and appreciate how it is developing, tour, and also do the business. But what is most important, as a region, as a partner state of the East African Community, this gives another level on how we can now begin appreciating how they are moving on in terms of observing security.
However, Rwanda is the only country that didn't participate in the competition yet, reflecting the deteriorating relation between Burundi and Rwanda. The East African Community Chairman of the Council of Ministers, Mr. Julius Maganda, says that Rwanda's absence hurts the spirit of the regional integration.
But for us as a region, we believe it would not be helping the integration agenda. If they don't come, we definitely will need to get the reasons. We shall also try to go deeper and investigate as to why they have not come. In the circumstance that it is the conflict that is between Burundi and Rwanda, then we shall definitely report such kind of matters to the summit, which should be able to address this kind of lapses that reduces the speed at which we want the integration to be.
In a joint letter wrote to the Speaker of the East African Legislative Assembly by the Rwanda's Parliament, regretted that the members will not be able to participate in the 2018 East African Community Inter-Parliamentary Games, as the sitting was already scheduled for the same dates. Obua Dennis is a Ugandan Member of Parliament and the team captain of Uganda's Parliament soccer team.
But we want to appeal to heads of state. We want to appeal to the East African Legislative Assembly to ensure that the issue of this relationship between Burundi and Rwanda is handled at that level, because these are brothers and sisters.
Burundi and Rwanda relations continue to deteriorate since 2015, as Burundi accused Rwanda of militarily training Burundi refugees to oust President Pierre Nkurunziza's government and sheltering the 2015 failed coup plotters. In return, Rwanda accuses Burundi of hosting the FDLR rebels, who are accused by the authorities in Kigali of committing the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The United Nations says that violence against women and girls is one of the most widespread, persistent, and devastating human rights violations in our world today, and it remains largely unreported due to the impunity, silence, stigma, and shame surrounding it. As the world commemorates the 16 days of activism campaign against gender-based violence, officials in Uganda say that some traditional practices, poverty, and low levels of education are responsible for the increase in gender-based violence in the country. Reporter Mugume Davis Kwakarinji files from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The campaign is commemorated globally from 25th November to 10th December every year. It involves governments, UN agencies, civil society, and citizens, calling them to join the fight against gender-based violence. PC Mutuzo, Uganda's State Minister for Gender and Culture, says gender-based violence includes physical violence, men on women, sexual violence, harmful traditional practices such as female genital mutilation, and forced child marriages. Minister Mutuzo says traditional beliefs top among reasons why gender-based violence remains high in the country.
In our cultures, many people know that when you beat a wife, it shows that you love her so much. But that's a myth. And those are things that our children, our young girls, should not grow up thinking. Because why doesn't it translate that when you beat up your husband or fight with him, it also translates to too much love for him? Even men, think that a no from a girl is a yes. So they continue engaging you up to when someone's really tired, to an extent of even forcing them.
According to a survey conducted by the Ministry of Gender in 2016, at least 50% of women in Uganda agreed that a husband is justified to beat his wife. On contrary, only 41% of men had the same perception. Poetess and women activist Caroline Achain welcomes this year's theme in Uganda, which is End Gender-Based Violence in the Workplace.
One time at a staff meeting, my views were dismissed and more focus was given to a male colleague who actually just copied what I had said, and it was accepted. I mean, it was my opinion, but I'm a woman, and that made me feel so bad. Then one time, a friend of mine was rejected at an interview by a potential boss who wanted her to sleep with him first before she was granted the job.
Unfortunately, Motuzo says, very often a few women report when their rights are violated.
They fear that they will not find anyone to marry them. They fear that their in-laws will get to know about it, and this one will humiliate them. And even when somebody persistently reports, the public understanding is that couldn't you do away without it? Can't you afford to keep quiet about it? So they keep shutting the girl's mouth, and so eventually they fear to go to courts to give evidence, and even witnesses do not wish to talk about it.
At least 1 in 5 women aged between 15 and 49 years in Uganda have experienced sexual violence at some point, and at least 8% men have also suffered gender-based violence. Frank Mugabe, the spokesperson for the Minister of Gender and Culture, says such violations can have grave consequences to both individuals and the country.
It's a huge cost, a cost of up to 50.5 billion spent in just managing these cases, by the way, just management alone. This involves the police, it involves health care, it involves, you know, taking, sheltering the survivors. We are saying, can we save this cost and have it invested in service delivery?
He says cases of GBV at workplace could have huge costs to employers, loss of productivity, legal expenses, less turnover, and harm corporate reputation. Consequently, he says this affects productivity and national development. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Research suggests that African audiences are exposed to more misinformation than American audiences do, and that the public's trust in the media on the continent is low, especially in countries like Nigeria, where they'll be having an election very soon. But a new project called Crosscheck Nigeria has brought together journalists from different news outlets to fight misinformation on social media. Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Concerns about fake news on social media have dominated debates in Nigeria over the last few years. Earlier this year, the Nigerian police said false information and provocative images on Facebook have contributed to killings in Plateau State, an area affected by ethnic violence. Now, a coalition of news outlets have emerged to verify information spread online with a recently launched website called Crosscheck Nigeria.
Not just coming out to say this story is false. We're coming out with a transparent investigation method that we adopt. We're going to tell you that these are the steps we took to prove that this story is false.
Ishaya Ibrahim is one of the journalists from more than a dozen news organizations collaborating under the banner of Crosscheck Nigeria to combat misinformation on social media, especially as the country heads towards the 2019 elections.
One of the politicians posted a photo that these are Nigerian aircraft bombarding Boko Haram locations in the northeast. And we also verified the photos, and we discovered that they were photos taken in Fallujah in Iraq in 2004. And so we came out to say, no, sir, you are misleading the public with this photo about Nigerian troops bombarding Boko Haram locations. So that's the much impact it is making to me as a person, and it is making the Nigerian media, where we are now collectively fighting fake news.
Recent research indicates that African audiences perceive that they are exposed to fake news about politics on a fairly regular basis. and that the public's trust in the media is particularly low in Nigeria. By working together to detect and verify content online, the Crosscheck Nigeria project aims to minimize the scope and impact of false information. Dayo Ayoton is the executive director at the International Center for Investigative Reporting, a partner facilitator of the project.
Also, the bloggers and even the Nigerians that operate on WhatsApp and other social media, when they know that there is going to be a debunk within minutes, then it will also impact on even our sense of responsibility in sharing what is fake.
Building on success of similar initiatives abroad, Crosscheck Nigeria is a collaborative project of First Draft and the International Center for Investigative Reporting. The website crosschecknigeria.org also welcomes contributions from the public with a call to send links or tips to a dedicated WhatsApp number or via Twitter and Facebook. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
As part of Cape Verde's strategy to eventually provide renewable energy sources for every one of its citizens, 4 wind farms have been installed on various islands. Today, at least 80% of the population gets some of their energy from wind. Anna Monterio, the manager of Environment, Social and Administration for Kabeulika, the wind farm company that built the farms, talks to Ricky Shryok about why more renewable energy infrastructure has stalled since the farms were built, and she also talks about what is on the horizon.
We use wind energy just like any other country uses wind energy. The special case of Cape Verde is that we are a developing nation with no natural resources, and we are, before this project, before the Kabeulika project, our electricity came, almost 100% came from fossil fuel-based conventional sources, which was extremely costly for the nation.
Do you know why, given the increasing demand and the seeming success of the wind energy project, there haven't been any more big renewable energy projects begun in Cape Verde?
The Kabeulika project was a huge leap at the time for the country. The government, like I said, didn't invest financially in the project, but the support that it gave was actually more important than financial contribution. It invested in giving government support. It would cover any costs that the utility wouldn't pay, things like that. So in any case, the government was hugely influential in having this project be completed and implemented.
There's a new government since then?
No, there has been a new government since then, but all the governments have kind of the same vision for Cape Verde and the same concerns regarding the burden of electricity, especially that produced by fossil fuel.
She was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, December the 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English for Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa, Dakar.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.